Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
In London, this is The Economist. You're listening to Tasting Menu with prime cuts from across this week's stories. I'm Anne McElvoy, head of Economist Radio, and on your menu, as part of our Open Future season, we explore the limits of free speech on campus and in stand-up comedy. Is there a formula for World Cup glory? And extra, extra, why there's still plenty of life in America's small-town newspapers. But first, our cover story. The Saudi Kingdom's law has just changed, allowing women to drive for the first time. So our editor-in-chief, Zanny Minton-Beddoes, got behind the wheel herself there.
It's now about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It's still about 50 degrees here, so it's incredibly hot. And there aren't actually many people of any sort on the road, not that many women driving at all. But it is a pretty extraordinary day. For the past decades, Saudi Arabia has been the only place in the world where women haven't been allowed to drive. And that has epitomised the repression of women in the Saudi Kingdom. And the fact that they can now drive is an important symbolic moment. It's actually an important real moment for a lot of women in this country who thus far have, if they had enough money, had to rely on hiring a driver or to use Uber. So life is really going to change for a lot of women.
It's the most visible symbol of a social revolution coming from the palace of the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman.
Cinemas have opened. Music is performed in public. The killjoy morality police are off the streets. Social liberalisation is part of the Crown Prince's ambition to wean the economy away from oil.
Saudi Arabia has plenty of critics in the West, but the whole world should care about its future, we said.
It is the biggest oil exporter and home to Islam's two holiest sites. It is central to the Gulf, the Arab region and the Islamic world. A more normal Saudi Arabia should moderate the Islamic world, by example, and because the flow of petrodollars to zealots would slow. Failure, by contrast, could spread turmoil to the Gulf, which broadly avoided the upheaval of the Arab Spring of 2011.
Worryingly, the reformer prince has already been reckless abroad.
His war against the Houthis, a Shia militia in Yemen, now centred on the battle for the port of Hodeidah, has brought disease and hunger to Yemenis, a missile war over Saudi cities, and embarrassment to Western allies that provide weapons and other help. With its main ally, the United Arab Emirates, or UAE, it has led the way in isolating Qatar, a contrarian emirate, by cutting land, sea, and air links. As the Arab Cold War spreads, Iran and other foes are gaining advantage.
While at home, he's developed a taste for repression.
The number of executions has risen. More dissenters are in jail, among them, perversely, women who campaigned to drive. Everything, it seems, must be a gift from the Al Sauds, the name of the country, the oil bounty, and now the right to drive a car. He has also adopted the view that all Islamists, even the non-violent offshoots of the Muslim Brotherhood, are as grave a menace as Sunni jihadists and Shia militias.
We argue that Mohammed bin Salman has a fragile golden opportunity as long as reform doesn't stall with the right to drive.
The Crown Prince could turn his popularity among the young and women into a political force. That would help him in what is likely to be a long reign once he becomes king. Right now, he is on the road to becoming another Arab strongman. As the Arab Spring showed, autocracy is brittle. Better to become a new sort of Arab monarch, one who treats his people as citizens, not subjects.
and you can read more in our special report on the Gulf in this week's edition of The Economist. It's available online and in all good newsstands. And if you're not yet a subscriber, you can get your first 12 issues for $12 by visiting economist.com/radio offer. Saudi Arabia's football team faces Egypt today in the World Cup. Here at The Economist, we've been trying to hit on the critical formula for World Cup glory. Apart from enough money and a decent-sized population, politics plays a role too. We wrote that dictatorships are rubbish at football, which requires more creativity and flair. Ah well, Professor Jürgen Moller at Aarhus University in Denmark wrote in to set us straight.
It would be neat if the beautiful game could only thrive in democracies. But this conclusion, which is based on data for the period between 1990 and 2018, is mistaken. Italy won two World Cups during Benito Mussolini's dictatorship in the 1930s, beating an authoritarian Hungary in 1938. Latin American countries such as Argentina, Brazil and Uruguay have had excellent international sides, both in democratic periods and when under military dictatorship. Dictatorships are, alas, not necessarily rubbish at football, but the countries that are still dictatorships today are.
We'd love to hear from you on any of the stories we cover, so do keep writing to us. You can reach us, radio@economist.com, or on Twitter @EconomistRadio. As part of our 175th anniversary Open Future season, the latest episode of The Economist Asks tackled the contentious issue of free speech. Across America, students have been demanding limits to what can be said on campus. One view we heard was from Professor Elaine Hadley of the University of Chicago.
Many people turn to the fact that young people are obsessed with social media, and they have been framed by the sort of demographical closed circuits where they only talk to people they like on Instagram or so on. But I actually have a slightly different view of that, which is I think this is a group that no doubt have been raised and grown on the internet. But that internet has opened up a version of the world to them that those of us in the older generation have not. They consume and interact in a global way that we do not. And I think we could learn something about what inclusion means in the free speech venue from the young people.
At the other end of the spectrum is Corinne Fisher, a New York stand-up comedian and host of the wildly popular podcast, Guys We... Ah, yes. Well, in the week ahead, our current affairs show, Corinne told me why she's such a firm believer in the right to offend. She recently pulled out of a feminist comedy festival after the organisers banned performers from criticising their own bodies during their sets.
I don't think these people understand what they're doing. Like, I think they're trying to protect everybody and we're trying to celebrate different body types. And all that stuff is great, but you cannot force people to think that heavier women are attractive by just telling them they cannot say otherwise. Censorship doesn't change opinions. It just puts them behind closed doors where, in my opinion, things are going to get even rougher because what we say behind closed doors is always 1,000 times worse than what you say in public. I try to say just as equally bad stuff in public, but you know.
What do you think? Go to economist.com/openideas to have your say. The latest episode of our Money Talks podcast considered the not-so-humble bicycle. No longer content with pedal power, cyclists are going electric. Our correspondent, Sasha Nauta, spoke to us from Amsterdam, long the capital of two-wheelers.
It's certainly noticeable as you ride through the famous Amsterdam Vondelpark that some people are suddenly going a lot faster than others. And interestingly, you know, the initial group that was targeted with these electric bikes were the slightly older cyclists to sort of give them a little push in the wind. So you'll see these sort of 55, 65-year-olds suddenly zooming past you. Turns out they've got a little battery in the back of their bike.
Bike sharing schemes are quickly cottoning on to the appeal of the e-bike too. But if two wheels aren't your style, perhaps you might consider something a bit different. A piece in our business section followed the sharing economy's expansion out into open water.
Few boat owners make regular use of their expensive assets. By one estimate, a French yacht slips its moorings on average for just 10 days a year. And for America's 12 million recreational boats, Typical annual usage is 2 weeks.
Now, though, the tide is turning in favour of the occasional sailor.
Marine versions of property sharer Airbnb or ride sharer BlaBlaCar are trying to match the two. America's leader is 6-year-old boat setter based near Miami. Founded by a sailing enthusiast, Jackie Baumgarten, it has raised $17 million of venture capital funding and notched up over 26,000 rentals.
Of course, it's not all smooth sailing.
Regulation, for one thing, varies widely. French law allows boat sharing, but in Greece, a tempting market, private owners face more difficulties. Renters usually need a boating licence or must hire skippers. Demand to get on the water is seasonal. Owners tend to be middle-aged and are reachable mainly by word of mouth or at boat shows.
But if you fancy something a little more flash...
Click & Boat has started a separate site, Click & Yacht, for chartering luxury craft for thousands of euros a day in places like the Côte d'Azur, for which there is plenty of international demand. It is one thing to stay in someone else's flat, it's another to captain a super yacht, especially when it looks like you own it.
And finally, from our United States section, an ode to the small-town American newspaper. Down, but certainly not out.
Jay Nolan surveys his media empire from a shed-like building outside London, Kentucky. On his desk is a stack of 8 newspapers, including the Berea Citizen, established in 1899, circulation 4,511, and the Pineville Sun, Cumberland Courier, celebrating 109 years, circulation 1,646. Together, the 8 papers have a combined circulation of about 25,000 and employ a dozen journalists and 9 ad sales representatives.
Gloomy circulation reports have been predicting the extinction of such publications for years.
America has lost a fifth of its newspapers since 2004. Media watchers worry about news deserts, or areas without any newspapers. The mere presence of reporters at city council meetings can help keep them straight, says Al Cross, the director of the Institute for Rural Journalism at the University of Kentucky.
But look behind the headlines, and there's life in the local rag yet.
The number and variety of newspapers that continue to exist, in tiny towns with populations in 4 figures, at gas stations in poor rural counties, and in villages clumped near each other, give hope to even the most pessimistic observer. As Mr. Nolan puts it, we have to have a free and vibrant press in America to be great in America. That is as true of little towns in the hills and hollows of Kentucky as it is in Washington, D.C.
That's the end of this week's Tasting Menu. Remember, you can get more of all the stories we've sampled online at economist.com. I'm Anne McElvoy. In London, this is The Economist.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.